Chapter 1, oil. Chapter 2, retail. Chapter 3, credit scores. We'll do credit scores. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Wednesday today, the sixth day of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Hey, look, oil dropped another dime today. West Texas Intermediate closed at $98.61 a barrel in New York, which will eventually show up in all kinds of other prices in this economy. That's the way oil works, right? It's in almost everything and is used to get almost everything where it needs to be. That said, anybody looking for long-term answers in short-term price relief might not be familiar with the way fossil fuels work. The Biden administration has reopened some federal land and offshore sites to oil and gas lease sales after putting a temporary pause on them earlier this year. That is being read by some as a sign that new fossil fuel production in this economy is viable, at least in the short term. But as Marketplace's Andy Euler reminds us, when it comes to pulling oil out the ground, getting a lease to drill is just the tip of the iceberg.
The federal government holds quarterly lease auctions that give energy companies the right to drill for oil and natural gas under public land. Now, less than 10% of the oil and gas production in the U.S. currently comes from that U.S. land, but Lucian Pularisi, president of the Energy Policy Research Foundation, says that's still nothing to scoff at.
Actually, if you eliminate all federal leasing, there are several studies out there that within 2030, you might be down 2 million barrels a day. That's not the end of the world, but that is about the net exports from North America are now.
The land that's currently being auctioned through tomorrow is about 130,000 acres, mostly in Wyoming. But Robert Johnston at Columbia University says there's more going on here beyond the oil and gas under the ground.
I think industry would probably argue that continuing with leasing kind of sends the positive signal. You know, the government supports leasing, and so to some degree that de-risks that type of investment.
Energy companies, the Exxons and Shells of the world, have had a hard time securing financing for big new fossil fuel projects lately. Investors are worried that long-term, fossil fuels don't have a future. Now, in the short term, many companies are still interested in securing leases. But Mark Finley at Rice University in Houston says obtaining a lease to drill is just the first part of a long process.
Companies stockpile leases that they then evaluate for their commercial prospects. Then they come up with a capital budget and plan their drilling and the logistics of getting the crews and the drills and all the equipment.
It's a process that, in uncomplicated times, takes many months, maybe many years. These are not uncomplicated times. The Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas published a survey recently noting that almost 95% of U.S. oil and gas drillers reported that supply chain issues are having negative impacts on their businesses. And until at least that gets resolved, any land that's been leased by energy companies is likely just going to sit there. In Austin, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
$4.78, by the way. That's AAA's national average for a gallon of gas. You were wondering, right? Come on, sure you were. On Wall Street today, it was green. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Here's an item from the top 0.00001% of retailers in this economy by size. Walmart said that effective August the 1st, it's going to start charging its suppliers transportation fees to pick stuff up from those suppliers. Retailers everywhere, of course, are dealing with higher costs thanks to fuel prices and the still stymied supply chain. But Walmart says this new fee is a way to keep prices low for their customers. We asked Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes how that's going to work.
There's a couple different ways that suppliers get their goods to Walmart. They either drop off the stuff themselves or Walmart collects it from them, says Jennifer Bartashis, a senior equity analyst with Bloomberg Intelligence.
Walmart will go and pick up those goods and then bring them back to the warehouse on behalf of that customer.
It's some of these suppliers, the ones Walmart's picking up from, that are getting hit with the new fees. Walmart said in a statement it's an effort to, quote, adapt to the dynamics of the current economic environment. And Bartasha says that current economic environment has been expensive, especially around transportation.
For example, when you think about trucking, there have been a shortage of truck drivers. But the number of goods that still need to be moved from point A to point B has only gone up. And that surge in demand results in higher costs.
Some other big retailers have started charging fees, too. And while suppliers probably don't like the new charges, most will probably just accept them. Because Walmart is a good account to have.
From a relationship perspective, I mean, who doesn't want to have Walmart as a customer, right?
Natalie Cutler runs the retail group for the accounting and advisory firm BDO. She says the suppliers will also try to pass those costs along.
They're going to try to see how they can minimize this pain, so to say, and maintain their own margins at the same time.
And while these fees may mean retailers can hold off on raising prices in the short term, eventually that pain will come back around. Nick Vias runs the Kendrick Global Supply Chain Institute at the University of Southern California.
Ultimately, we as a consumer will have to pay for it. The supplier will, at some point, will build into the cost of goods sold and pass that cost back to consumers.
It's almost like a game of whack-a-mole where there is no winner. Push costs down in one place, they'll pop right back in another. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
Okay, from the top 0.00 whatever percent of retailers, we're going to go way down the business size chart because it's not only the retail behemoths that are trying to figure out a way to get by. We've got a whole roster of small business owners that we talk to from time to time, of which Annie Lang Hartman in Leelanau County, Michigan is one.
Business so far this year has been pretty great. We rebranded from Compass Paper Company to Wild Letty. And because of that, we had to be so organized with making sure we had new products and all the packaging in place. Once we got over that hump, we were able to focus on opening our seasonal store in Fishtown for the year. And because we were so organized from the rebrand, things went really, really smoothly. As far as costs for us, shipping has gone up considerably, but for the most part, none of our vendors have raised their prices, which is just, we feel so lucky. Because of that, we have not had to raise our prices. We wanted to, for quite a while now, open a second location that can be a year-round location. And it's happening for us, and we're very excited. I think I'm taking a very, very big risk opening another retail location. Once we get over the hump of having our doors finally open, I definitely am sitting down and really pushing to create a nice big cushion again to help us get through whatever is going to happen.
That was Annie Lang Hartman. She runs Wild Letty, the stationery and sundries store formerly known as Compass Paper Company. They're up in Leelanau County, Michigan. Here's one of the truisms of life in this economy. How you do, literally the kinds of jobs you can get, where you can live, and what kind of car you drive, all of that hinges in some not small part on a seemingly random three-digit number. The team over at Marketplace Tech has been digging into credit scores lately, specifically the algorithms that generate them. Data about you and your credit history go in, and a judgment about how risky you are as a borrower comes out. But like algorithms in a whole lot of other parts of our lives, the mysteries behind credit scores can reflect and sometimes can perpetuate bias and systemic inequality. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has our story.
Credit scoring algorithms, basically advanced sets of calculations, rely on millions of credit profiles of all sorts of consumers. People with good credit, bad credit, meh credit, and that data often creates clusters.
Many times, credit scores are built on a history of all kinds of other aggregate data. So often your score is relative to other people's scores. And this is where we start to get in trouble.
Your credit score can determine the type and cost of financial products you can access, like loans, mortgages, insurance. David Silberman is a senior fellow at the Center for Responsible Lending.
If one starts out without any wealth, with limited income prospects, the kinds of credit you can get is going to be affected. Your ability to repay that credit is going to be affected, and that's then going to itself find its way into credit scores.
According to payments processor Shift, white Americans have an average FICO score of 734. For Black Americans, it's 677. Nicholas Schmidt is CEO of Solas AI, which vets algorithms for disparate impact. He walked me through one example of how bias can creep into a seemingly neutral data set. Take an algorithm that assessed credit risk. When it came to people who didn't pay credit card debt,
the best predictor was how often you shopped at a convenience store. And I thought about it. What do you get at a convenience store? Cheap beer, cigarettes, bad candy, and lottery tickets. Those are all probably pretty well correlated with risky behavior, which is probably well correlated with bad credit card outcomes. Seemed reasonable.
But then Schmidt realized there was a gaping hole in that analysis. Food deserts.
Here I have pizza and frozen chicken.
Ekram Aman is a cashier at the Penway Market, a convenience store in southeast Washington, D.C., which doesn't sell beer or lotto tickets, but is in a food desert. Many of Aman's customers are eligible for food assistance.
Most of the people who come here, they use their EBT to buy some groceries.
So a model that relies on shopping at convenience stores to determine credit risk might accurately capture risky people buying lottery tickets in the suburbs, but, says Nicholas Schmidt from Solas AI,
and you're going to apply that to creditworthy people in the city. And so that's an example of discrimination creeping in through what at first looked to me like a reasonable factor.
Schmidt doesn't know if that particular variable ended up in the lender's final model. Financial services firms often adjust their models to account for built-in biases. But, says David Silberman at the Center for Responsible Lending, there's only so much these algorithms can do.
There may be tweaks that will, on the margins, bring more people into the system or give a fuller picture of their creditworthiness by looking at a richer set of data. But I think that's marginal. It's not going to deal with the fundamental problems of inequality that we have to deal with.
And that, he says, will take much larger societal and political fixes to the economy. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Coming up.
So the expression we sometimes use is every tub on their own bottom?
Not even a clue what that means. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 69 points today, 0.2%, 31,037. The NASDAQ found 39 points, 0.3%, 11,361. The S&P 500 picked up 13 points, also 0.3%, ended at 38.45. If you know what it means, by the way, tub on bottom, whatever thing, hit me up on Twitter, Kai Rizdal. Check me out. Honestly, because help. Amazon is adding Grubhub membership as a perk for its Amazon Prime customers. Shares of rivals of the food delivery service thus took a hit. That's the way it works. DoorDash down 7.4%. Uber gave back 4.5%. As for Amazon, well, it was up 0.7%. The deal also includes an option for Amazon to take a small stake in Grubhub's parent company. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note thus rose to 2.92%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We have come to that place in the economic cycle where governments are giving people money. To be clear, the economic cycle that we are in is far from a normal one. Pandemic hangover, inflation, you, I'm sure, know the list as well as I do. So about a dozen states are sending checks to residents who qualify. Tax rebates is what they're being called, mostly. Also, inflation relief checks, depends on the state. In California, for instance, taxpayers are going to get as much as $1,050, depending on income. In Indiana, it's $125 regardless. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab looked into how states are deciding how much to give and to whom.
It's easy to compare these state programs to those federal stimulus payments we got at the beginning of the pandemic, but...
Stimulus, I don't know that I love that word in this context.
Joshua Hausman, a professor of public policy at the University of Michigan, says these state programs aren't supposed to stimulate the economy. They're supposed to help people deal with rising prices. But maybe you already see the problem here.
This is not a good idea if you care about inflation, because the way inflation falls is for people to spend less. And so sending them money does exactly the opposite.
A few states handing out a few $100 won't increase the price of gas or groceries, but if a bunch of states do this, it could have an effect on the economy. Dan Wilson, an economist at the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco, says these programs should target recipients.
They want to give as much money as possible to the groups that really need it at the moment, but limit the total amount of money that's going out in order to limit the, you know, the fuel they're throwing on the inflation fire.
Wilson says states are in a good place to do this. They have local data about the cost of living, wages, and household savings. Still, Wendy Edelberg, an economist at the Brookings Institution, says it would make more sense to increase SNAP benefits and child tax credits instead, or pay in installments.
Sending people big checks gives us a higher probability that they're just going to go out and increase their spending all at once.
She says in reality, though, governments don't have the resources to coordinate all this. Plus,
more cynically, I'm sure they want the help to be salient. That's just the nature of politics.
I mean, really, who doesn't like free money? I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Kristen was talking there a minute ago about states giving tax money back to people specifically. Sometimes, though, it's communities or cities that need money from state and federal governments to make things work right at the local level. And that is money that often just never comes. What happens when that happens is the subject of Michelle Wild Anderson's new book. She's a law professor at Stanford. The book is called The Fight to Save the Town: Reimagining Discarded America. And question number one that I had for her was, what exactly is discarded America?
As you know and have reported on this show, we have these giant metropolitan engines for our economy, the big coastal urban hubs. And outside of those hubs, with the exception of a few college towns or tourist destinations, so much of the broader territory of the country is really reaching for a foothold in the modern economy.
What are the signs? What are the things, as you set out to research this book, which we should say, as most books of this caliber do, has taken years, what were you looking for?
Part of what I went looking for was places that were up against these incredible challenges of concentrated poverty and government decline, but were different from each other, so that we could see what was really going on in this larger problem across the country.
One of them you spent a lot of time on in this book is Lawrence, Massachusetts. Tell me about Lawrence, would you?
Oh, I fell so in love with Lawrence, Massachusetts. It's a relatively small town, overwhelmingly Latino, but it has always served as this portal for new immigrants coming into the country and trying to make it in the northeastern economy.
And it's got a history. I mean, it's, you know, famous probably mostly as a mill town, but it's been active industrially for centuries now in this economy.
Yeah, it has an iconic American history. Actually, it was the home to the Bread and Roses strike of 1912, which got textile workers across New England a 15% raise. And one of the reasons I really came to focus on Lawrence now is that it's focused on that same kind of raise again for its people. So how would you get a 15% raise today in this economy? So they had to draw on this incredible history of interracial cooperation and partnerships to really address this living wage problem in a creative way.
So let's talk for a second about activity at the local level when towns and cities like Lawrence, for reasons that we'll get to in a second, realize they're kind of on their own.
Yeah, you mean on their own from federal and state governments?
Well, yes, that's the get to it later part. But that's the bottom line now, right? As that we have seen many times on this program and in other reporting I've done and in this book, that local governments realize they're on their own because federal and state money either isn't coming or isn't coming fast enough. And it's sort of a by the bootstraps kind of thing for these towns and cities.
Exactly. That's so well said. I mean, states and the federal government can help equalize funding across local governments. But basically, since the 80s, we've generally done less of that. And during COVID, local governments got extra funds briefly, but they needed those funds to make up for acute local losses. So the expression we sometimes use is every tub on their own bottom, which I don't really love.
I don't even know what that means.
But the idea is that local governments have to rely more and more on revenues that they take up from within their territories.
Taxes. Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah, taxes. But infamously, after the Ferguson protests, we, you know, really started to reveal and investigate the degree to which really low-income governments in so many cities were wringing money out of their poorest residents' pockets through fines and fees.
Right. Just to interrupt. This is Ferguson, Missouri, after Michael Brown and the discovery of the police department and others really, really imposing what are taxes, but in the form of fines on the less fortunate in that city.
Exactly. So in the civil justice system, in the criminal justice system, coming through police officers, coming through code enforcement, there are all kinds of ways that local governments can take money from their people, even outside of taxes and fees.
Okay.
Even outside of taxes.
Right. So let's cut to the chase here for a second and get back to where we started, which is the subtitle of this book. I asked you about Discarded America, but you it's a three-word subtitle, and it's Reimagining Discarded America. How do we reimagine discarded America in a time when, as we know, the federal government has its own challenges, states have their challenges, and cities and towns are kind of left on their own?
I'll just rewind for 2 seconds, Kai, and just say that the bottom line of this book is it's about places that are both poor and broke. They're broke in part because they're poor, and their people stay poor in part because their governments are broke. Mm. But I don't think we have enough time to just talk about problems like that anymore. And so you're right. The book is rooted in solutions, rebuilding super basic public services, treating the traumatic impacts of gun violence, increasing adult wages, and stabilizing families against eviction and foreclosure. I would describe it as a form of mutual aid at the city level, like kind of sitting around a table, you do this, you do this, you do that. Mm-hmm. And together we're going to move on these giant problems, sort of one project at a time.
It's a book called The Fight to Save the Town, Reimagining Discarded America by Michelle Wild Anderson. She's professor of law at Stanford. Professor Anderson, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you.
This final note on the way out today brought to us by the acronym JOLTS, the Job Openings and Labor Turnover Survey that's been getting oh so much attention the past year or year and a half as people are making pandemic-inspired changes in their lives. Anyway, the May JOLTS came out today. There were, We are told 11.25 million job openings in this economy that month, down from about 11.7 million in April. Still, though, with just shy of 6 million people looking for work, there are still almost two job openings for every one job seeker. And as you know, because we tell you, Jay Powell and the gang at the Fed keep a real close eye on that. All right, we got to go. Here is your moment of economic context. A little more Fed geekery just because I can. The minutes of the most recent meeting of the central bank came out today. The meeting, you'll remember, where they raised interest rates 0.75 percentage point instead of the 0.5 percentage point that everybody had been guessing. Anyway, a little control F on that file today gets you this tidbit. The word inflation appeared in the minutes 90 times, 90 times. The word recession, zero, zip, nada. Make of that what you will. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Jake Cherry, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Dorado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.